Chapter 13. There's an instant flare of alarm that isn't John's, a wash of fury, and the person spins. John ducks the high slash of that knife, sees the shape of a blaster a moment before it snaps up, to aim and fire in one motion. Redirecting blaster bolts is something a child can do, though, and John flicks it down into the floor, takes a half second to judge his own readiness, and then lunges. John's used to assassin meaning quiet on the occasions that he's encountered them, so the very last thing he's expecting is the thermal grenade that drops right between them. There's a fraction of a second to react as the assassin flings themselves back, over the far edge of the bed and down. John throws up his hands, but he's not healed enough for intangibility, doesn't dare try something as draining normally as teleportation. A barrier is easy, but blocking the heat of the explosion takes more concentration and won't leave any for... The grenade detonates, and John slams pure force into a shield, feels the heat sear his arms, his face. The impact sends him slamming backwards, clear across the room, and he hits the edge of the door, hard enough to steal every last bit of his breath. His chest feels like it compresses, sending his vision swimming, and he drops, not able to draw in air but still moving, forcing himself up to his feet and around as a shape bursts from the smoke. There's a deep, tearing ache in his stomach, but John grits his teeth, grabs for whatever strength he can spare, and shoves a hand against the wounds Montross gave him, dragging them towards healed with a burst of pain that makes his vision go black for an instant and a great roaring rise in his ears. It's only pure instinct that lets him feel the next blow coming. Wrenching back, John feels the edge of a vibroblade open a line down his cheek, registers the sharp hot ache streaking through his nerves, but ignores it and throws out a hand. One of the heavy chests along the wall skids forward, bursts upward, and the assassin can't dodge it in time. It hits them full on, and they cry out, slammed backwards and down with a crash. John follows, leaps the chest, and comes down in open space as the assassin twists, flips, rolls out of the way, and right to their feet. "Who are you?" he asks, rough. And in the shadows, it's hard to pick out any identifying features, but he thinks he sees a scar across one cheek, two parallel lines with a third straight down through them. There's no answer, just a careful tensing. The assassin's hand strays towards another grenade on their belt, not quite reaching for it yet, and John stops. "You don't need to do that," he says quietly. "If you surrender, you won't be killed." "Mandalorians don't surrender," the assassin says, low, and faster than John can react, they snap a hand to their belt, drag the whole thing free, and John's breath tangles in his throat at the glow of not one, but all of the detonators activating. "No," he says, and takes a step. Belt wrapped around their arm, the assassin hits him full on, tackling him to the floor. John can't help the cry that's jarred from him, the shock of pain that bursts through his whole body, but he rolls, kicks, tries to get them both up, but the assassin isn't moving. They pin John, a knee colliding with his stomach, hard enough to make his vision swim, and John grabs for the force, but concentration is hard to come by. He can't let the grenades go off in Jaster's rooms, with all of his books and weapons as collateral. Can't let them go off in the compound, with so many people beneath the same roof, and the threat of structural damage. It's already been too many seconds, counting down, and John feels an arm lock beneath his chin, and slams his head back. The assassin hisses, jerks, and their grip loosens just enough. John rolls, rises, grabs them, and with every bit of strength and force-assisted movement he can summon up, he hauls them up, hurls himself forward, and turns as he leaps. They hit the glass of the door to the garden, and John feels it splinter beneath his back, hears the assassin's cry, and then they're through, rolling down the steps and into the heavy beat of the rain. The assassin doesn't even try to get up. They just grab John, hands wrapped inextricably in his tunic, belt of detonators between their bodies, and hang on. And John digs his fingers into the leather, closes his eyes, quiet the fear, accept it. No emotion, just peace. Breathe and focus. Space warps, and John hits the grass a dozen paces away, then throws up a hand. A barrier in the Force, the kind that lets desperate Jedi spacewalk or survive being submerged in lava, and he grits his teeth as the ache of effort hits, but focuses. There's a shout behind him, running steps, but there's no time. The grenades detonate, all of them at once, and John can feel the instant of the assassin's death, life winking out half an instant before the force of the explosion hits the barrier. John doesn't try to contain it all, he just blunts the intensity, contains the worst of the wave of force, then lets go. There's a thunderous clap of sound, loud enough to make John's ears ring, and he throws up a hand to shield his face from the burst of shrapnel, feels a piece graze his forehead. It hurts, but not enough to notice through the sucking sort of exhaustion, and he collapses back to the grass in the rain, trying to catch his breath. John! A voice cries, and an instant later, Arla hits the ground beside him on her knees, grabbing his shoulders and pulling him over onto his back. John, what in the nine hells? Assassin, John manages, and gets a hand up to catch her wrist before she can reach for his tunic. I think they were after Jaster. Arla's breath is shaky, but she nods, raising her calm. I need a medic outside of Jaster's quarters, she orders curtly. Hurry. John debates trying to tell her he's fine, but it's very possible he's not, given the numb burning that's settling in across his stomach and chest. Miles, he says instead, and Django. Arla's hand closes over his, the grip of her gauntlet almost bruising. Django has a guard on him, she says. Miles isn't in his room, though.
He'd told John where he was going to sleep. It's just hard to remember right now. John digs through the memory of their conversation, ignoring the hazy edges, and then says, Bunkroom, he said. Arla's breath is all relief, and she straightens for a moment, calling something to one of the other Mandalorians with her. Quick footsteps retreat, and John realizes belatedly that there are several squads nearby, including a pair of women turning over the remains of the assassin's body. He doesn't look. John, Arla says, low and fierce. Don't you dare. Keep your eyes open. Look at me. It's logical, that order, and with an effort, John forces his eyes open, looks at her. Thinks about trying to heal himself, and grimaces. Help me sit up, he rasps, and Arla's mouth pulls tight, but she slides an arm beneath his back, carefully pulls him up, and John gets a hand on her shoulder, braces himself, and presses his other hand to his stomach. Bending space and creating those barriers took most of his strength, but not all of it. Days more rest than he normally allows himself has helped with that, at least. Ruthlessly, without giving himself quarter, John shoves power into torn muscle and reopened wounds, bleeding every bit of effort he can spare into it. It tears, feels like days' worth of pain compressed into a single second, and he has to lock a cry behind his teeth, muffle it as best as he can as his fingers go bone white on Arla's armor. It feels like the world lurches, or maybe he does, and when everything straightens up, John is breathing hard, still hanging onto Arla, with her arm tight around him and his ears ringing. John! John! What the carking hells was that, you slime-brained nerf herder? Healing, John croaks, and shakes himself. Pretends that it doesn't make the whole world spin sickeningly, and raises his head. With a curse, Arla shoves him down again, jerking his tunic open, and the sound of her breath catching is all too obvious in the dark and rain. "Criff," she mutters, pressing her gauntlet against scarred skin, the lack of fresh wounds. "I didn't know Jedi could do that." "Some," John allows, and tips his face to the cool rain, just breathing for a moment. There's a pause, and then Arla snorts quietly, leaning over him. "Miss the ones on your face," she points out. "Too much effort," John tells her, and when Arla tugs lightly at his arm, he grimaces, but lets her help him sit up again. "I couldn't, just the worst of it." "At least you got that much," Arla says frankly, and blows out a breath that's equal parts relief and indignation. "Well, at least Jaster ran off with my squad and got himself out of the line of fire. The assassin tell you anything about who sent them?" John shakes his head, digs his fingers into her pauldrons, and lets her lever him up to his feet with a groan he can't quite strangle. "They just said Mandalorians don't surrender." Arla sighs, pulling her helmet off and tucking it under one arm. Her hair is still in the same thick, heavy plait it was earlier, twined with a pair of ribbons in gold and red, but significantly more ruffled now. "Well, at least whoever it was didn't contract out," she mutters. "Anything, Tori?" One of the women looking over the body shakes her head. "They blew themselves up thoroughly," she says, disgusted. "If there's any sort of mark to show where they came from, we're going to need a pair of tweezers to find it." John blinks a few times, his head still fuzzy, and then shakes himself. "They had a scar," he rasps. And when Arla looks at him, he draws it on his cheek, the one that isn't bleeding. Two parallel scars, and then one that cut through them perpendicularly, old and faded, but still obvious. "That sounds familiar," Miles says, coming down the steps, and Arla's head jerks up. She almost lets go of John, then apparently feels his waver and thinks better of it, reaching out instead. "Miles," she says, "next time you decide to disappear in the middle of the night, tell me, you bastard." Miles catches her hand, squeezing it gently for a moment before he lets go with a smile. "Sorry, Arla. It was late and I was tired, so I went right to the bunk room and didn't even think of it. John." John waves a hand, trying to convey that he's fine, but it clearly doesn't work. Miles frowns, then says, "Get him inside, Arla. You called for the medics." "First thing," Arla promises, and practically lifts John off his feet as she pulls him back up the stairs. "Security teams are sweeping the compound, but there haven't been any other attacks yet, and we haven't found any holes in the security. I don't know how they got in." "The tunnel," Miles starts, but before he can finish, John is already shaking his head. "It wasn't through there," he says, and tries not to gasp too audibly when Arla lowers him onto the bed. Curls in on himself, just for a moment, as the blooming bruises on his back pull, and the muscles in his stomach ache, and the seared skin on his arms throbs. He can't help but think that Dark Woman would be immensely displeased by his showing against one assassin who wasn't even Force-sensitive, but he beat them. Even hurt, he managed it, and managed to heal the worst of his wounds at the same time. The assassin didn't kill anyone, or destroy any sections of the compound, and in light of that, John is too tired to worry about what his master would think of his methods. There's a pause, and then Miles crouches down in front of him, looking up at John with a faint frown. "John," he asks, "if it wasn't the tunnels, how did they get in?" John shakes his head. "The tunnels just don't sound right," he says hoarsely. And after a moment, Miles huffs out a rueful breath and inclines his head. "I agree," he says. "We'll keep looking then, and you need to spend the rest of the night in medical." "You can keep Django company," Arla says, merciless. "I'll double the guard on the place and double-check the security systems myself." "And I'll see about getting Jaster a new bed," Miles says dryly, straightening. John grimaces faintly. "Sorry," he says quietly. "I didn't..." Arla rolls her eyes and thumps him very gently on the top of the head. "Don't apologize," she warns, like a threat. "Better the bed got stabbed than you. Then Jaster really would have had a heart attack." "He's still going to have a heart attack," Miles says, and reaches up. Arla catches his hand before he can touch John's face, pulling it back, and Miles blinks, casting her a questioning look. Arla ignores it, sinking down next to John with a handful of inches left between them. John is grateful for it. Touch always feels like a lot, and he's not entirely sure he could handle it right now. "That's what he gets for running off with my squad," she says airily, and smirks at John. "You should be able to leverage this for years, you know. Saving his life when he was being dumb is a good bit of emotional blackmail that he'll never escape." "Spoken like someone who's employed it more than once," Miles says, dry. Arla just grins at him, unrepentant, and he rolls his eyes. "Just make sure not to actually give him a heart attack when he gets back." "I wouldn't dream of it," Arla says, perfectly insincere, and John ducks his head to hide a smile, half a second before the medics descend. It is potentially rather possible that Jaster should have listened to his advisor and his fiancé and brought rain gear with him. As such, he's wet, cold, and indignant when he drags himself back in the early morning light, along with the rest of the squad. Sleeping on the ground in the rain wasn't a pleasant experience, given the fact that the first spot they bedded down was in a hollow between several hills and ended up filling with rain like a particularly unpleasant soup bowl, and all Jaster wants is a scalding cup of caff, a very hot shower, and to crawl into bed with a warm, sleep-pliant body he can curl himself around. The attempt to give John a night's reprieve from being smothered by the man forcing him into marriage seems to have backfired, Jaster admits with resignation, if only to himself, and can't help but sigh in relief as the compound's gates come into view. With luck, John will already be up and about, removing the temptation, but if he's not, Jaster is feeling miserable enough that he might just ask John to stay in bed with him all morning. A dangerous request, given all the myriad ways Jaster wants him, but Jaster is weak, and he's cold, and he's miserable, and the image of John warm and willing beneath him, or warm and soft with sleep and tucked up against his chest, is too much for him to resist. He'll gladly take either at this point. There are more guards than he would have expected outside, arrayed in front of the gate and along the fence, and Jaster pauses to consider them for a moment. But Arla is always careful, and when she's angry, she's spiteful about it. So odds are this was planned so as many of their troopers as possible see him dragging himself home in mild disgrace. Resigned to that as well, Jaster raises a hand in greeting, and is mildly surprised when one of the guards immediately steps forward. Silas, Jaster thinks, a little surprised. He's one of Django's closest friends, and generally keeps himself close to Miles, who uses him as an assistant. Having him be doing something like guarding the wall... "Silas," he says, pulling his helmet off with a frown, flicks another glance across the heavy guard, and then asks, "Did something happen?" "Yes, Mandalore," Silas says grimly. "Someone managed to slip through the defenses last night." Turning, he waves the gate open before Jaster can answer, and heads inside. "Arla wanted to be alerted as soon as you returned. She should be here any moment." Which means, Jaster thinks grimly, that they're leaving Arla to tell him, because he'll take the news better from her. That's not a good sign at all. "Miles," he asks, not able to help the flicker of dark fear that roots in his chest. Anyone looking to hurt him would target Miles. Miles is more than able to take care of himself, but... "Jaster!" With a burn of her thrusters, Arla hits the ground, staggers a step, and then throws herself the last few feet down the hill to meet him. "Any problems? Did anyone get hurt?" "No," Jaster says, and the question alone is enough to make his stomach clench. "It was a wet night, but quiet. Who got through?" Arla hesitates, then pulls off her helmet, meeting his eyes. "An assassin," she says plainly, bluntly. "Looking for you." "For him." The breath freezes in Jaster's lungs, and he stops dead. If an assassin went after him and he was gone, that means they were left with John, he says, tight with the horror he tries to strangle. Arla's mouth tightens, and when she nods, it feels like the bottom drops out of Jaster's stomach. He's alive, she says, which isn't nearly as comforting as she probably means it to be. The assassin blew themselves up and tried to blow him up with them, but he got out of the way in time. He's hurt, but he'll recover. Jaster closes his eyes for a long moment, forcing himself to take a breath. Then, brisk, he steps past Arla and heads for the house, not hurrying, but certainly not lingering. In the medical wing, he asks, already turning that direction, but Arla grabs his arm and pulls him in the opposite direction. Your rooms, she says. The medical droids released him, and he insisted. Miles is with him. They released him. That's something, at the very least, and Miles's presence is even more. Jaster sets his jaw, lengthening his strides, and asks, any other injuries? Arla shakes her head, her mostly unraveled braid sending locks of blonde hair sliding into her face. No, there was just the one, and they headed right for your rooms. Someone told them where to go, Jaster thinks grimly. His rooms are unremarkable from the outside, and this compound hasn't been occupied in years. Simply scouting the exterior wouldn't have told them anything. But the idea that there's a traitor amongst the ranks of the true Mandalorians is unsettling. That was Montross, who fell so far in his jealousy and pride that he joined Tor. Jaster isn't enthusiastic about facing another like him. I'm working on it, Arla says, clearly able to see where his thoughts have gone, and Jaster forces himself to breathe out, nods, and reaches for her. Arla ignores the gesture, a silent signal that she isn't willing to be treated softly right now, and Jaster understands. Assassins are a sore point, given what she was nearly made to do as a child. He lets his hand drop, and Arla casts him a crooked smile, but keeps moving. I'm sure you are, Jaster says, and means it. But you're at your best when you've taken time to feed yourself and rest your body. Silas and Tori are more than able to take up the slack while you see to the necessities. Arla sighs, but runs her fingers through her hair. I need sleep, she allows, and then hesitates. A flicker of vulnerability surfaces for a fraction of a second before it's ruthlessly crushed, and she asks, with more force than the simple question needs, after I wake up, will you braid my hair? Always, Jaster confirms, because he's never given a different answer and never will, and Arla's breath is all faintly shaky relief. She nods, curt, like that will hide the way her mouth pulls, and then drags her helmet back on. Go coddle your husband, she orders. He needs it. I'm going to do one more patrol of the wall and then find an empty bed. Sleep well, my child, Jaster says quietly, and Arla reaches out, wraps the reinforced back of her gauntlet against his pauldron, and then turns off where the hallway splits, leading for the exterior. Jaster watches her go, then grimly turns his eyes forward, following the corridor down to his own doorway. The sight of a pair of guards outside turns like relief in his chest, and he nods to them, gets a nod in return, and pushes through the opening, letting the door slide shut behind him. It looks like there was a fight. There's a scorch mark on the stone, and the rug that was there before is gone. The bed is new, even the frame, and plastoid panels have been rigged up in the gap where the glass door into the garden should be, but Jaster doesn't have eyes for the damage, just for the room's occupant. John is sitting up on the bed, hair pulled back in a messy knot, a new scar crossing several other older ones on his cheek. There's another new scar across his temple, just visible beneath a few stray strands of dark hair that have escaped the bun, and he's sitting like he's too aware of parts of his body. In pain, Jaster thinks, and it aches, low and sharp in his belly. John, he says, stepping forward, and John's eyes immediately flicker away from Miles, rise to meet Jaster's, and there's a flicker of relief on John's face that makes something in Jaster's chest lurch. Jaster, he returns, rising carefully, and Jaster crosses the space between them in three long strides and reaches out. John doesn't flinch this time, doesn't hesitate. He steps forward, and Jaster takes that as permission to sweep him up into a tight hug, wrapping his arms around him and tapping their foreheads together. There's a shiver, but before Jaster can start to worry, John sags into his grip, like all the tension is bleeding out of him, and Jaster has never wanted to kiss someone so deeply and desperately. He doesn't, because John is clearly not doing well. Instead, he draws him closer, gently slides a hand down his back, and breathes out. Loops his other arm around John's shoulder, letting John tuck his face into the curve of Jaster's throat, and turns his head to press a kiss to his dark hair. "Think everything you're safe," Jaster says, and it's hoarse despite his best efforts. John dead, killed because of him, isn't something he can bear to contemplate. Part of it is guilt for being the one to put John in this position, but not all of it. Not enough of it, likely, to count himself a moral man, but... John shivers as Jaster's thumb traces over his nape, and his breath is warm against Jaster's skin, his hair soft against Jaster's cheek. Jaster would be entirely content to never move from this spot again, to never separate, to live out the rest of his days with John tucked in tight against his chest. And then, soft, John says, "You're wet." Miles chokes on a laugh, and Jaster shoots him a narrow look that promises retribution. He doesn't stop the gentle stroke of his hand down John's spine, though, and just hums. "Absolutely drenched, yes. My very wise future husband told me to bring rain gear, but I'm afraid I trusted the weather report over his senses." "You mean his sense," Miles mutters, but when John laughs a little against his throat, Jaster decides he is graciously willing to forgive the temerity. Tightening his grip just a little, he breathes out into John's hair, soothes the resulting shiver, and says, low and soft, "I think today calls for a very long stretch of it spent in bed. Would you stay with me?" John's fingers tighten on his armor, and he nods, quick and short. Doesn't raise his head, but that feels like answer enough right now, and Jaster closes his eyes, presses his cheek to John's hair again, and breathes out. John is here, and alive, and safe now that Jaster has returned. Just for today, he needs comfort and safety, and Jaster's guilt won't wait, but he can set it aside and focus on John for now. It seems like the very least that he can do. End of chapter 13.